You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. On today's program, Iraq heads to the polls in the first parliamentary election since the US withdrawal 3 years ago. Stuart Purvis of City University here in London and Jeffrey Kaufman of ABC News will be with me for the next 30 minutes to discuss that and the day's other news from around the world. Also ahead, we'll be in Hungary to celebrate one of the country's most famous exports, the Rubik's Cube, which has just turned 40.
What's interesting about the Rubik's Cube is it's part of a whole spectrum of Hungarian inventions that people don't always know about.
And before the end of the program, we'll bring you our daily review of one corner of the arts in one corner of the world and today. We are in Italy to review some of the biggest recent hits on Italian television. That is Midori House with me, Markus Hippi, right now. So, lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is James Luckhurst with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. Ukraine's acting president Oleksandr Turkinov has warned that his forces are helpless to quell unrest driven by pro-Russian activists in the eastern regions of the country. Mr. Turkinov said the goal was now to prevent the unrest spreading. Activists have seized a number of government buildings and taken hostages, including international monitors. Mr. Turkinov also said Ukraine was on full combat alert amid fears that Russian troops could invade. Russia has previously argued that it has the right to defend Russian nationals in Ukraine, but Ukraine's UN ambassador, Yuri Sergeyev, insisted there is no threat.
Ukraine has never threatened Russia and never will. Ukrainians want to live in peace and want to be left alone. The highest level of cynicism is a Russian reference to the right for self-defense in a situation where it is Russia who is acting as aggressor, having occupied Crimea, and today is brutally interfering in the internal affairs of Ukraine, destabilizing and trying to create an explosive situation in the eastern regions of Ukraine.
An explosion has hit a railway station in the capital of China's far western region of Xinjiang. There have been some injuries, but so far few details. Correspondents say the explosion is likely to be seen as an embarrassing security lapse for the government. The blast happened at Urumqi's South Railway Station and came just as President Xi Jinping was wrapping up a tour of Xinjiang, in which he spoke of plans to get tough on fighting terrorism. Voting has closed in Iraq's first parliamentary election since US troops withdrew 3 years ago. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is hoping to win a third term in office amid a growing insurgency in the west of the country. Australian officials leading the investigation into what happened to Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 are downplaying suggestions that wreckage from the plane may have been found in the Bay of Bengal. Search coordinators have dismissed a discovery by a private company, insisting they're satisfied the Boeing 777 came down in the southern Indian Ocean. The United Nations Rights Chief Navi Pillay says a personal power struggle between South Sudan's leaders is driving Africa's newest nation to the edge of ruin. Mrs. Pillay's visit was prompted by a rebel attack on the South Sudanese oil hub of Bentiu this month that left hundreds dead and a revenge assault by rivals on people sheltering in a UN base. The UN Security Council has called for an investigation into the killings and is considering sanctions against both sides. Mrs. Pillay spoke to journalists.
The country's leaders, instead of seizing their chance to steer their impoverished and war-battered young nation to stability and greater prosperity, have instead embarked on a personal power struggle that has brought their people to the verge of catastrophe.
Hundreds of mainly women protesters have marched through the Nigerian capital Abuja to press for the release of 230 schoolgirls abducted by militants 2 weeks ago. The protesters are asking the government to negotiate with their captors to secure their release. The Islamist group Boko Haram has been blamed for abducting the girls from their school in Chibok in Borno State. Nepalese officials have held a condolence meeting for the 16 Sherpas who died in an avalanche this month during their climb to Everest. Mountaineering officials and climbers bowed their heads to observe a minute's silence and offered incense. The memorial was attended by the families of the Sherpas, with some of the widows carrying small children. President of the International Mountaineering Association, Gyera Todladze, called on all climbers to contribute to support the families of the Sherpas.
We must support these families, children, especially children, because they have not fathers now, and fathers who go to climb mountain to help to another clients who take part in these expeditions, and they die when they make this duty. This is a very big job.
The British actor Bob Hoskins has died after a bout of pneumonia. Hoskins, whose roles ranged from London gangsters to FBI chief J. Edgar Hoover, and who starred opposite a cast of cartoon characters in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, retired from acting in 2012, saying at the time that he was suffering from Parkinson's disease, an incurable muscular disorder. Mr. Hoskins was 71 when he died. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
That was James Luckhurst with the latest news headlines. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We are back right after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, eu, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time in Bangkok is just 7 minutes past midnight here in London, 18:07, and it is 13:07 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Stuart Purvis from City University London and Geoffrey Kaufman, London correspondent with ABC News. Welcome both to the programme. Good to see you here again. Let's begin the discussion in Iraq, where Iraqis across the country have been casting their vote today in the first parliamentary election in the country since the withdrawal of US troops in 2011. The vote comes at an increasingly precarious time for Iraq. Thousands of civilians have got killed in attacks across the country since the beginning of this year. There are also claims that Nouri al-Maliki, the current prime minister, is leading an increasingly authoritarian government, which his critics say is compounding the emerging fault lines between Iraq's Sunni and Shia communities. Stuart, if I could begin with you, how crucial is it for Iraq that these elections get carried out successfully?
Well, it's very important because it's obviously the first election since the Americans left. Now, it didn't need Americans necessarily to hold elections, but in a sense, the troops on the ground provided some kind of security support, though clearly there are still bombs going off every day, or if not every day, most days. There's still people dying, so it's not a great setting for an election. Maliki is just an intriguing figure, isn't he, really? I mean, when he started emerging as a contender to be the prime minister, I think the coalition powers were never quite sure whether he was part of the problem or part of the solution. They were never entirely sure, you know, what was his hand in the sort of death squads. But, in a sense, there are sometimes parallels with Russia here. Being a strong man appears to have some appeal to some people in some country, and he certainly appears to be that. Though I'm sure people continue to have reservations about what may be going on behind the scene.
Indeed, it is Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki who is hoping to win a third term in the office. Geoffrey, what do you think? Is this a favourable option if we think of stability in Iraq?
Well, you know, the politics of Iraq remind me of what, when I was a young kid trying to understand from afar the politics of Northern Ireland, the terms unionist and loyalist and sectarian, and it was impossible until I actually went to Iraq to report on it, and then I had to really do my homework to understand the divisions there. You have to understand that this is a country that is about 31 million or so, if I remember correctly, 97% Muslim, but divided. Two-thirds Shiite, one-third Sunni. And the thing that you have to understand is that since the 18th century, it has been ruled by the Sunni minority. And now we have a Shiite prime minister who left Iraq as a young man because the Sunni dictator Saddam Hussein was after him and was killing so many of his people. He came back when Saddam fell and in 2006 became prime minister and has won two elections since. And so what you want in a situation like that is a Mandela, a man who can bridge the gulf between the two people. Maliki is not that man. He harbors a lot of resentment. He harbors a lot of anger towards the abuse, centuries of abuse, but in particular Saddam's abuse of the Shiite majority. And he has of late exacerbated, in particular in Al-Anbar province, the western province that borders on Jordan, that is really a majority Sunni province.
Stuart, do you agree with them?
I do, and it's just interesting to think back 10 years to the whole coalition plan. You know, how naive was that, that somehow there was a kind of, if not a Westminster democracy or a Washington democracy, some kind of liberal democracy was going to be implanted here, that it was going to become, a kind of giant airstrip, which would be the Western world sort of, you know, jumping off point for all sorts of actions in the area, and all built really on, I'm not sure ever quite understanding the difference between the Shiites and the Sunnis, which, as Jeffrey said, it goes much to the heart of this. So it's interestingly how rarely it gets mentioned, certainly in the British media nowadays, as if it's a kind of episode which everyone would kind of rather forget. And I'm not sure, I don't see enough of the American TV coverage to know how big it features there.
It doesn't feature at all, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, since I reported there in 03, 04, and 05, and essentially American TV stopped putting it on because, in fairness to my editors, the American public was, every time the anchor would say we're going to Iraq, they would switch channels. And, you know, we have the technology to know that. And when you lose a third or more of your audience when you put a story on, every time it happens, you start to see a pattern. And there just isn't, Americans have switched off the topic, to be candid.
And when we are looking at these elections, the campaign for the elections was a violent one. As mentioned in the beginning of this discussion, this year has been very violent in Iraq. Iraq is experiencing its worst unrest, as a matter of fact, since 2008, with as many as 160 people killed in the past week alone. Do you think these elections could work as a real step towards a more peaceful Iraq?
There doesn't seem to be any evidence to that because, okay, to get through the elections without American presence is a step forward in itself. But it's the sort of, you know, the divide in the country, it doesn't seem to be healed by this process. I mean, there's no sign of it getting any better. In fact, it could be arguably getting worse. So it's great that people get to vote. It's great there's some kind of accountability. But is it a kind of healing process? It doesn't seem to be.
Have you seen, when you've been looking at different people over there, and when you think of potential candidates who could be the future prime minister, is there anyone who could basically bring together Sunni and Shia communities?
You know, Maliki's popular because he's strong. When you have anarchy on the streets, and this is something that, you know, when you cover stories like this, you begin to understand. All people want first is security. They want to know that they can go out and get some milk, that they can, or bread, that their children can go to school and come home safely. And ultimately, all the talk of ideology and democracy means nothing if those fundamentals don't exist. And because they don't exist, people turn to the strong man, and that is, and that's what Maliki is playing on. That in particular, this rise of the he says the Al Qaeda backed terrorists. Those are what he would call them in Al-Anbar province to the west of Baghdad. That we need a strong central leader, a firm hand to keep the streets safe, and that's what he's appealing to.
Jeffrey Kaufman and Stuart Purvis, let's move the discussion on to another story now, and the idea of American interventionism, which it seems many Americans are becoming increasingly tired of.
America's interest in security and America's belief in liberty both lead in the same direction, to a free and peaceful Iraq.
We are imposing sanctions on specific individuals responsible for undermining the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and government of Ukraine. We're making it clear that there are consequences for their actions.
If Russia chooses the path of de-escalation, the international community, all of us, will welcome it. If Russia does not, the world will make sure that the costs for Russia will only grow.
When I see people whose lives have been destroyed, when I see the bodies of these children that have been gassed with chemical weapons, when I see all these things and I see us sit back, oh, we're war weary. Well, I don't buy it.
Under President Obama's leadership, we've ended the war in Iraq, begun a transition in Afghanistan, and brought Osama bin Laden to justice. We have also revitalized American diplomacy and strengthened our alliances.
Some of America's recent leaders on America's place in the world there. Well, an opinion poll published by the Wall Street Journal and NBC News suggests that almost half of those questioned would rather the US take on a less prominent role on the world stage. The poll also shows that the popular approval of President Obama's handling of foreign policy has sunk to the lowest level of his presidency. Jeffrey, what is your take on this? What do you see happening in the U.S. now? Why are Americans getting tired of the policies of their government?
I think there are 4,500 very good reasons in Iraq that explain why Americans are tired. The 4,500 American soldiers who died from 2003 to today for what we were just talking about. It's not clear that anything was achieved. In fact, they're sliding into civil war if they're not there already. And I think, you know, you look at Afghanistan, it's not very hard to understand why Americans have no appetite to see more bloodshed on behalf of other people's problems. That said, there is a huge contradiction running, and it's a current that really you can trace back to the early 19th century, if not the founding of America, where you have these currents of isolationism and an aggressive foreign policy. And they're very much in conflict now, because on one hand, you have the rhetoric of the right, some of which we just heard, saying America must assert itself. We are the superpower, you know, and we will make all right, and American values will prevail. And at the same time, in the same breath, from the same people, we don't want to shed any more blood. We don't want to spend the money.
Also, at the same time, do you think the fact will ever change that whenever a crisis surfaces, one of the first questions everyone is asking is what Washington thinks about it and what Washington plans to do about it?
Well, absent anybody else to whom one could turn for the kind of strength which America has traditionally offered, no. I mean, would one look to the European Union for that kind of instant judgment? The answer is absolutely not. But, I mean, I think the Ukraine will be an interesting testbed, if you like. I mean, clearly, although Britain and the United States are signatory to a pact under which we're meant to defend Ukraine if it's invaded, it has been invaded and nobody did anything about it, effectively. Now we're beginning to see that maybe these economic sanctions against Russia may have some effect. So if I was Obama, I'd sort of understand, rather like Jeffrey, kind of how we got to where we are. I mean, you know, if you take of the sort of post-Cold War, that it seems to me it was quite easy to be a strong man in the Cold War, because you never actually had to do anything. You just had to look you were going to do something. Since the Cold War, you know, American foreign policy has actually involved going out to places and doing things. And broadly, that hasn't been terribly successful in Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan. And so, you know, the body bag count has been a pretty big factor. Can you come up with an alternative foreign policy based on sanctions which offers a way forward? I don't think we know yet. Let's be clear. If Russia effectively annexes eastern Ukraine, that will be the kind of end for American foreign policy, I guess, in the current generations, because both will have seemed to have failed.
It does raise the question, what's the point of having a dozen aircraft carrier with some billions each if you're not actually ever prepared to use them? And that's certainly what Putin is testing. You know, I think one of the exasperating things about what we're looking at, if you're Obama himself, is this sense that he's not even, you know, he hasn't even faced his midterm elections in his second term, and he's already really facing the prospect of being a lame duck president, a term that is used very loosely in America to talk about the last 2 years of an 8-year run for a president, that essentially they don't have any power because everybody's looking at the next person. And that next person, of course, all eyes are on Hillary Clinton. This poll that you're referring to suggests that she is still very popular. She has some issues of a political dynasty and the baggage of being another Clinton, but she is potentially a very forceful leader. And given her expertise on the world stage, it would be interesting to see, you know, how if she does run, and I think she will, it'll be interesting to see how she articulates her vision.
And just on a principle theoretical level, if the U.S. was somehow to make its role in the world politics small. Are we talking about some kind of a sum game over there when we're looking at Russian aspiration of making Russia more influential? Would someone actually take that position?
If I understand your question, and I'm not sure I do, Russia has a limited scope. They can lash out in Ukraine. They can't go into any of the NATO countries because the NATO defense pact will kick in. And so Russia is really going for the weakling in the schoolyard by going to Ukraine. And, you know, this is it's a small game that Putin is playing. But, you know, he's a strategist and he's doing it very effectively. I do agree, though, that these economic sanctions may, in fact, have some impact. It's interesting, you know, this is not the Russia of the Cold War. Russia's economy is very much tied to the Western economy, as much as Western Europe's oil is tied and gas are tied to Russia. And so there are factors at these sanctions can really squeeze Putin, and while his arrogance and his defiance may fuel him at some point, he needs to have some sense that the people are still with him, at least, and his the oligarchs are still with him, or the power brokers, I should say.
Let's continue with a short break. Now, you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi, Stuart Purvis and Jeffrey Kaufman. When we return, we'll ask why political violence appears to be on the rise in Germany. Do stay with us.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Stuart Purvis and Jeffrey Kaufman. And we head to Germany now, where new figures released yesterday suggest that politically motivated crimes in the country are on the rise. In the past year, the German authorities say over 31,000 politically motivated crimes were recorded, a rise of some 15%. Xenophobic attacks and attacks against police officers have also risen substantially in the past year. Stuart, without wanting to root the figures out of their context, what is your initial reaction to this news?
Well, these numbers are extraordinarily high, which you immediately wonder, how do you define a politically motivated offence? You know, is it, for instance, daubing on somebody's door or what? I mean, we don't have comparable figures for, say, Britain or France, but I would be surprised if there were figures were anywhere near as high as this. So which one presumably looks for, well, I mean, if we look back on from the left, obviously, we have things as violent as the Baader-Meinhof gang going back a couple of decades. And then from the right, we've always had neo-Nazi activity. But I still can't reconcile those kind of traditions, if you like, with this scale of what is reported to be going on.
Acts of politically motivated violence linked to left-wing politics are increasing sharply in Germany. That's according to the numbers. And at the same time, the ones connected to the right wing remain high. They don't seem to be increasing that much. Jeffrey, do you have any ideas what's been going on in Germany?
You know, I think that we have to look across Europe at the patterns of recent years. And you know, if you go from Golden Dawn in Greece to the right-wing parties in Scandinavia, in the Netherlands, the old order has been upset, and the issue of my immigration, migration, absorption is really it continues to eat at all of these countries as people fight for something that is disappearing. And you know, Germany has not been terribly effective, nor has France, in absorbing immigrants. You know, I remember coming across doing some work on the issue of Turkish migrants in Germany, and one of the things that one of the German people said to me was that you know, we thought that they would come, they would do well, they'd go home. We never thought we needed to include them in our society, and yet that's exactly what's happened. You know, migrants often quite like where they go, and they build a community, and they don't want to go home. And yet Germany didn't make a great deal of effort, certainly not the kind of effort that we see, you know, where I come from in Canada, where the notion of multiculturalism is actually enshrined in the politics of the nation, and in the U.S. to a certain degree the same. where people become part of the nation they join. When you allow communities to remain separate, it does leave these kind of things festering.
Stuart, what is your suggestion? I know this is a tricky question, but what should Germany do when it's facing these kind of numbers?
Well, I mean, I think certainly in Britain, politicians have tried to redefine multiculturalism in a sense that at one point, for instance, if you were an asylum seeker who came from many countries to London, you would be offered, don't bother to learn English, we can show you all these different languages, we provide all these language services. But now people are saying, no, people really must learn English. Now, I'm not familiar enough with Germany to know whether they have gone in any kind of absorption in terms of saying to people that you really must learn German and become more part of the society, or the other option, which seems to be we respect your cultural tradition, you can live in a separate community. But these kind of numbers, and it does appear that much of these are crimes against asylum seekers, it begs some explanation and it begs some action, really.
Stuart Purvis and Jeffrey Kaufman, let's move to our final area of discussion today. Yesterday, the owner of the LA Clippers professional basketball team, Donald Sterling, was banned for life.
I love this
from
story.
The National Basketball Association following the appearance of an audio recording in which the 80-year-old billionaire is alleged to have made racist comments. This is an excerpt of what the NBA commissioner Adam Silver had to say as he announced the ban on Donald Silver.
Effective immediately, I am banning Mr. Sterling for life from any association with the Clippers organization or the NBA.
I think just this is clear that you don't need Steven Spielberg to make Jurassic Park. The dinosaurs still roam the earth.
Exactly. And Stuart, what are your initial
thoughts?
Well,
I've listened to this tape, and it is a quite extraordinary thing, because basically it's somebody chatting to his girlfriend. And his girlfriend is somebody who's promoted her profile very actively on Instagram. And she appears at times to be almost acting as an agent provocateur to get him to say things. So how this tape came to exist is quite odd. What strikes me as a kind of European about this is the reaction. I mean, first of all, I completely condemn what he says on the tape. I can understand why action by taken. But actually, for the NBA to say that he has to sell his interest in the team, for the NBA, I mean, I cannot think of a European equivalent of that. If you own a sports franchise, in the States, it's clear that the organization at the NBA or the NFL has extraordinary powers over you, the ability to force you to sell. So I can understand why everyone's excited about it and everyone's worked up about the racism. I have slight misgivings about the recording itself, and I slightly have slight misgivings about whether organizations can actually inflict these kind of punishments on people for personal views expressed
indeed,
on tapes.
It is indeed pretty extraordinary, considering that someone gets a lifetime ban, indeed, and an owner of a team gets a lifetime ban himself.
Well you know, this is America, where there's either they either ignore it or they react with a wrecking ball. And in this case, though, I do think, Stuart, that the context, having as a Canadian who spent a lot of years living in the U.S., you just cannot underestimate, how grossly offensive these comments are in a country that has struggled with the issue of racism and inclusion for so many years, in a sport that is dominated by black players, by African-American players. To have this owner say these outrageous things about his girlfriend not being seen, why do you have to be seen in the arms of black people and things like that, which is what he's saying. Yeah, I agree. The recording made me uncomfortable too. She's clearly egging him on. She knows she's got a recording, something in her purse, or she's wearing a wire or something. Yeah. That being said, this is a man who has a history of these kind of things. And I think that the NBA is playing to several constituencies here, as well as the public, as well as government officials. They've got to deal with their own players, who these are powerful, wealthy men who are African American, who have every right to be completely offended by this idiot's comments. And you're right, it is a distinctly American thing that they would go so far, but at the same time, it's very hard to have any sympathy for Sterling.
We'll have to leave it there, unfortunately, already. Stuart Purvis and Jeffrey Kaufman, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo.
Това е Монако 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there is plenty more to come on the second half of today's edition of Midori House. We'll hear from one of our correspondents around the world. We'll review the week's television offerings from Italy. And we will also speak to Zoltán Bözmörney, one of Hungary's most inimitable novelists.
Tomáš, who emigrates to Canada, it's myself. But that's the reality. Everything what has happened and happens in the book afterwards is the fiction.
But before we get started on all that, here is James Luckhurst with the World News headlines.
Ukraine's acting president, Oleksandr Turkinov, has warned that his forces are helpless to quell unrest driven by pro-Russian activists in the eastern regions of the country. Mr. Turkinov said the goal was now to prevent the unrest spreading. Activists have seized a number of government buildings and taken hostages, including international monitors. An explosion has hit a railway station in the capital of China's far western region of Xinjiang. There have been some injuries, but so far there are few details. Correspondents say the explosion is likely to be seen as an embarrassing security lapse for the government. Voting has closed in Iraq's first parliamentary election since US troops withdrew 3 years ago. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is hoping to win a third term in office amid a growing insurgency in the west of the country. Australian officials leading the investigation into what happened to Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 are downplaying suggestions that wreckage from the plane may have been found in the Bay of Bengal. Search coordinators have dismissed a discovery by a private company, insisting they're satisfied the Boeing 777 came down in the southern Indian Ocean. Hundreds of mainly women protesters have marched through the Nigerian capital Abuja to press for the release of 230 schoolgirls abducted by militants 2 weeks ago. The protesters are asking the government to negotiate with their captors to secure their release. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much. That was James Luckhurst with the latest news headlines. And we continue with a check-in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Hungary. And our Budapest correspondent, Adam Labor, joins me on the line. Hello and welcome to the programme. Let's start with rather dramatic finance news. The European Union is postponing over €1 billion in subsidies for Hungary as it is worried about certain legal changes. What exactly is going on there in Budapest, Adam?
Well, what the European Union is saying is that it needs to check all the many legal changes that have taken place in the last 4 or 5 years since the current government came to power in 2010 to see if those changes are in line with European Union norms. Now, they're not stopping the money. They're kind of suspending it for a while.
So what kind of legislation are we talking about? What exactly has changed over there?
Well, since the government came to power in 2010 and then just won the re-election a few weeks ago, it brought in a new constitution, and although the constitution is supposed to be kind of set in stone, it kept changing it. It's altered it 5 times since then. And also we've seen a lot of changes in the way that the government works, a lot of centralization, streamlining of political power. And that's raised a lot of eyebrows in Brussels as to whether this is really in line with the usual way that a modern democratic state should work.
So is the European Union worried about democracy in Hungary, or is it worried about where the subsidy money is actually going?
I think it's a bit of both. The opposition here says that you have to kind of be politically connected, you know, have good connections with the ruling Fidesz party to get your hands on the European Union money, which is a large amount. Of course, the government denies that and says that these procedures are absolutely transparent and political considerations don't come into it.
And then, Adam, another story you would like to talk about is a continuing row over a planned Second World War monument. What would that be like?
Well, this is a story that's arousing furious passions here and just doesn't seem to go away. The government's going to build on a place called Freedom Square in the heart of downtown Budapest a monument which it says is for all the victims of the Second World War. But the form of the monument has caused huge controversy because it takes the shape of the Archangel Gabriel, representing Hungary being savaged by an imperial eagle, which is representing Germany. Now, understandably, the Germans are quite unhappy about this. The Americans are unhappy about this. And also the country's Jewish community is unhappy about this. And people on the left-wing opposition are unhappy because Hungary was not an innocent victim of the Germans during the Second World War. It was an ally. Hungary willingly joined up with the Nazis and the Italian fascists to fight. So it's a very warped view of history we're getting here.
Do you think plans for that monument are going to change? It really sounds like no one is really happy with the current plan.
Well, the government's happy with it, I think, and the government will go ahead with it. We hear that, you know, this is something supported by the Prime Minister, Viktor Orban. And in Hungary at the moment, you know, Viktor Orban is the primary political figure, the Prime Minister. And if he wants it to go ahead, it will indeed go ahead. And there have been many protests there over the last 2 or 3 weeks of people trying to disrupt the construction. But the police have moved in now and people have been arrested and taken away. So it really does look like it's going to go ahead.
In general, how sensitive a topic is the Second World War still in Hungary?
It's hugely sensitive because, as I said, Hungary fought with the Germans, and during the Second World War in 1944, about 500,000 Hungarian Jews were deported to concentration camps and were killed there. And none of that could have happened without the cooperation of the Hungarian state.
Let's continue with something slightly lighter after that. There's been a bit of celebration in Budapest, I reckon. Rubik's Cube has just celebrated its 40th birthday.
Yes, this is a great occasion for celebrating. Rubik's Cube is one of the most famous Hungarian inventions in the world. But what's interesting about the Rubik's Cube is it's part of a whole spectrum of Hungarian inventions that people don't always know about. The synthesization of vitamin C, Hungarian scientists played a huge role in inventing nuclear weapons as well. So really, without these clever Hungarians, modern life would look very different.
That is very impressive indeed. How proud are Hungarians of these inventions?
Oh, immensely proud. I mean, yeah, and you've also got to remember this is a very small country. So it's an awful lot of inventions that have come from a small number of people, like more, for example, than have come from the Slavs.
And how was it celebrated, Rubik's Cube's 40th birthday then?
I don't think it was an occasion for huge celebration. It's just something that people noted and kind of ticked the boxes. Oh, yeah, another one of our clever guys done something that's, you know, been made famous across the world.
Adam Lebor, Monocle's Budapest correspondent, many thanks as ever for joining us. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll speak to author Zoltán Bozmornei right after this. Do stay with us.
On this week's edition of The Foreign Desk, we head to Africa to ask the liberation question.
It was across ethnic lines, across class lines, across religious lines, and they all came together in this broad alliance.
As South Africa prepares to vote in an election that the ANC will win outright, we'll ask why liberation movements that came to power decades ago have rarely been voted out.
You know, I thought that old thing, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts, was just one of those phrases. But I think in the last few years, it's been proved true time and time again.
From Zimbabwe to South Africa, Namibia to Somaliland, we'll assess how liberation movements across Africa have fared so differently as they transition from rebels to the holders of power.
In some ways, Somaliland has got the most democratic, fair political system in the whole of East and the Horn of Africa.
That's the liberation question, this week's edition of The Foreign Desk on Monocle 24.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews,
passionate debate and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Marcus Epitis, 2114 Moscow, 1840 here in London, and 1340 in Washington, D.C. Time to head to the world of books. And today we hear from one of the most colourful Hungarian authors. Zoltán Bözmörny's novel, The Club at Eddie's Bar, won a number of awards when it was first published in Hungarian a few years ago. The book is a story of a young journalist who, during the last years of the Cold War, has to flee his East European home country, and from a refugee camp he is admitted to Canada, where he tries to start a new life. There are many similarities to the life of the author Bözmörny, who also had to flee his Hungarian home community in Transylvania for Canada. The Club at Eddie's Bar has just been published in English, and I met the author himself in this Midori House Studio One. He started by telling me how he got the idea for this book.
Every author, I think, himself is the idea of writing the book, and he is the genesis of what he's doing. And you see, Tomasz, who emigrates to Canada, it's myself. But that's the reality. Everything what has happened and happens in the book afterwards is the fiction.
But is it so that when you write, when you're working as an author, you actually find quite useful material in your own life from your own experiences, so you know how things work?
You cannot avoid yourself. You always have to turn back to yourself. Well, it's not my idea. You know, I studied literature and other writers, and Thomas Mann has done the same. Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, and I don't know a writer who is not himself the center of the universe in his literary work, in a way.
Zoltán, your book has, the Hungarian version has won numerous prizes and it's been a success. What do you think? What is it that resonates with people? What has made them like this book so much?
The readers love to read a story which resembles their life, in a sense. I mean, they see that this is a true story, and they can have that purification of the mind and soul at the end. Because if you remember, Aristotle in his Poetics said that a good tragedy is when people, you know, frightened the fear and pity that aroused in their soul, afterwards, you know, everything just is solved. And comes the catharsis.
I noticed that you have indeed studied literature. Is it also, I'm thinking of your readers, Hungarian readers, they have actually possibly gone through some same things. They know what you're writing about when you're writing about the last years of the Cold War and what's going on over there. Do you think this is something that the people need there still? Someone to write about what they may have experienced?
Well, you know, memories. We are going back to memories. First World War, 100 years from the First World War. My great-grandfather fought in the First World War and died in the First World War. Certainly I will remember. But this is only the pretext of something. Pretext for the story to be told.
And as you've already made clear, and as I've mentioned as well, there are some... It's not a book about your life, but there is some material that is from your own life you've been using in this book. And when I did my research, I found, for example, that you were a ballet student in Romania.
Yes.
And you published books of poetry, and one of the books actually resulted into you being arrested and interrogated by the Romanian security services. And quite a story. After that, you know, gradually through a refugee camp in Austria, you found yourself from Canada.
Well, it wasn't a fortunate thing what has happened to me, but it was important to be Hungarian for me since I was a kid. In that part of Romania, especially in Transylvania, that was not very well received, this idea that we still think Hungarian, they want to be Hungarian, to defend our culture, our identity, and so on and so on. And certainly, these poems reflected in a way that desire of what I had, the necessity which came from within myself. And they were reflected in the poems. And then the security police called me and, you are a nationalist Hungarian. You are promoting, you know, the Hungarian culture. You want Transylvania to go back to Hungary and so on. So that was the pretext and the discourse about my being faulty with the ideas they are expressing in my poems.
And also, when we look at the situation the Hungarian people in Romania are finding themselves at the moment, do you think the situation is acceptable and good nowadays? Or do you feel like you still want to improve the situation they're facing over there?
Well, I think that a lot of things can be done, and especially in the European Union community. And I think now Brussels will be more attentive of what is going on in those areas where ethnics are living. So numbers, big numbers, like Hungarian in Transylvania. And I think that, yes, they will. It's important for them. And it's important for Europe as well.
Zoltán Bözörmény, you actually wrote this book, The Club at Eddie's Bar, in Hungarian first. And then quite often the story continues so that someone has translated the book. But no, you rewrote it in English. Why was that?
Well, it was an experience. Because, you see, this book, it's not exactly the copy, the mirror of the Hungarian edition. What I have done, I have rearranged the chapters, the chronology of the events, and I tried to shape it in a way that resembles an English novel. Because I thought I have to do something for the English reader in order to be more friendly for them.
So how do you describe the difference? Are you saying that English literature works differently from Hungarian literature?
Well, the literature works in a way, but the audience can be different. And if you are used, you know, with a certain pattern of the English novel, American novel, then it means that you have to comply in such a way to shape the story in a way to be liked by the reader. Yes.
That was author Zoltán Bözörmény, whose book The Club at Eddie's Bar is out now also in English. You are with Midori House. Well, before we head to the world of Italian television to close today's program, let's pause for some music. This is Naomi with Bagnati dal Sole. That was music from Italy, Naomi with Bagnati dal Sole. You are listening to Midori House. And we finish today's program with our daily review segment, where we check on one corner of the art scene from one corner of the world. And today we are talking about Italian television. And joining me on the line is Luca Mastrantonio, culture editor of Corriere della Sera. Welcome to the program. We're going to start by talking about the voice of Italy. But before we start the discussion, let's hear what's been going on in the program. So that was from the voice of Italy, Luca Mastrantonio. What's been going on this far in that program?
Hi to everybody. Yeah, this is the holy weapon of the voice of Italy we heard. The most surprising TV show at the moment in Italy. And there's a talent show, of course, on the second public channel, but it's a great success and we have something different in front of the other talent. Because of the format, mixing in a good way talent of the singer, the show, and the composition of the judges, the cultures of the judge, the coaches. We have an absolute pop icon like Raffaella Carrà. He's a singer used also by Paolo Sorrentino for the parties in the La Grande Bellezza. And she's old but evergreen in Italy. And there's also a young singer, Noemi, and then a well-conserved rocker, Piero Pelù, and the first real hip-hop singer in Italy, J-X, who broke out in the 90s. So it's really a mix music culture in this format, and of course the holy weapon of the format, the Catholic nun, Sister Cristina Scuccia, 25 years old, from Sicily, with an incredible voice and a nice face. It was a great surprise. She's the protagonist absolute of this edition. I remember maybe 1 month ago the rendition of Alicia Keys' No One. She stunned not only fans of the show, but the judges and journalists. Everyone was amazed.
That sounds amazing. Is she still with the show?
Yeah, it's still, because it's the first, now is ended the first part with the knockout, and then there will be the second part with the live show. So going on.
It sounds like when I speak to my Italian friends, we cannot discuss, cannot escape this topic of the Voice of Italy.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's just the Vatican without Pope Francis at the moment. She's the star, but I think she is revealing that the Catholic culture has still a great spectacular potential. Less politics, more music, I don't know. But anyway, it was really revealing for us.
Is anyone offended by having a nun in this kind of a program?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was seen good from everyone, from any kind of newspaper. It's something maybe we respect because she's a nun, but she's a girl, a young girl, and she had a great voice. I write a quote that a reference that I like, that when a judge asked her why you are in a show, she answered, "I have a natural gift and I want to give it to you." I think it's a great message.
That sounds amazing. There's been something else going on in the Italian television, though, as well. And the next program you'd like to talk about is called Sfida.
Yeah, I like it because it's really simple. Sfida means challenges. It's on the third public channel, Rai 3. And it's an amazing storytelling show, especially about great protagonists of the sport, the pop culture, the Italian history. And we have a great anchor man, Alex Zanardi. He's a former Formula One driver and now a paracyclist. He lives with artificial legs after an accident, a terrible accident. But he's amazing. He's an amazing guy with friendly voice and face. And he expresses the strength of a person that didn't give it up. And it's really shown in her way of hosting the show.
So can you tell us more about the format? What exactly happens in each episode?
It's a sort of, we take a man, a story, and it's shown the challenge with himself, with the destiny, with the others, mixing old and new interviews, film from archive, and a simple but really effective and, of course, well-written voice-off. So it's really, it's simply, but if the story is great, the effect is really great. I like it. I think it's a sort of pedagogical show because really, really, really clear.
Luca, let's finish by talking about Il Testimone, which is also a program on MTV. And it's got something to do with the mafia as well.
Yeah, of course, because it's a journalist program, and Testimony is the witness, and the star, the program is written and also by Pierfrancesco Di Liberto, PIF, it's the short version, from Palermo too, just like the nun from Sicily. And it's a strange, the format, it's really interesting, because this man goes to the place where people live in the south of Italy with a problem with mafia, or where homosexual don't know how to live in the south, or in Milan where fashion victim is a plague, is just like a problem for the normal person. But the way of he made the show is really interesting because he handled the camera in a double way. Shooting what he looks around and shooting himself in the scene. So it's a strange way of to be the witness of something, because he decides the images that we have to see, just like a judge, but he's a witness. He only put himself in interesting and sometimes dramatic situations.
That sounds really good. I wish I was in Italy with you watching television. Now, Luca Mastrantonio, culture editor of Corriere della Sera, thank you very much. And that's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Stuart Purvis and Jeffrey Kaufman. Today's show is produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Alexa Firmanich, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexandra Stenbock-Firmer. Our studio manager was Joel Church. Next, after the headlines, is The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove. And then at 2200 hours is The Monocle Daily. Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson will be with you for that. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.
From London
to Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam,
a Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.